Democrats and Republicans are further apart ideologically today than at any time in the past 50 years. That's according to the Pew Research Center. The midterms proved to be far less of a red wave than expected, with Democrats flipping Republican-held seats and staving off Republican wins in several key battleground states. But with an increasingly polarized electorate and a deep cynicism towards the electoral system among many in the United States, what hope is there for a functional democracy? Joining me to discuss this is Anand Giridharadas. He is the author of The Persuaders, at the front lines of the fight for hearts, minds, and democracy. Good to see you. Thank you for joining me on Up Front.
Thank you for having me.
There were a lot of crucial issues at stake in this election, from gun control to reproductive rights to the high cost of living. There were even fears to some that democracy itself was at stake. Yet, despite all of that, the political landscape really didn't change that much. In fact, some people called it a stunning return to the status quo. What does that say about our electoral processes?
I don't know that's the case, in the sense that there were, as you say, very big issues at stake. And over the course of the last several months, Democrats actually did a remarkable job of linking various forms of freedom into a closing argument, the freedom to choose your leaders, aka democracy, the freedom over one's body, I think particularly resonant with young people, the freedom to thrive on a planet that thrives, and framed the kind of increasingly dangerous Republican Party hijacked by Donald Trump and oriented toward a kind of fascist vision of America as a kind of dangerous force that will not help you or your family.
I think what we're also seeing, though, is despite that compelling closing argument from Democrats, we ended up with an electoral outcome. So far, we have the same basic red states, same basic blue states, same partisan gridlock. It seems to me that despite making these compelling arguments about the status of democracy and the planet and reproductive justice, we're kind of in the same place in terms of the political landscape.
Look, would I prefer to be living in a world in which a kind of fascist Republican Party isn't winning any seats at all? Yeah. And I think part of what I argue in The Persuaders is that it's not enough to eke out these narrow victories. The thesis of The Persuaders is that it is time for a freedom movement that cannot eke out 51-49 or 55-45 victories against American fascism, but that can actually build a dynamic, rooted, connected, thrilling, and transcendent movement that can beat the crap out of that movement durably for the era to come.
In your latest book, The Persuaders, you write about how we can change things by changing minds, that persuasion is essential for achieving progressive victories. We're living through a time where you say that Americans are being offered a clear choice between liberal democracy on the one hand and fascism. So how do people on opposite sides of the political or even ideological spectrum engage each other if the alternative is so extreme, even fascist, as you put it? Who are the real persuadables?
Yeah. So this is at the heart of the book. And I didn't have the answer to that myself as much as I would love to. So I spent time over the last few years reporting on people who are doing this work. And I think a lot of the most important work that I saw is happening outside of the national limelight. It is organizing work. It is base building work. It is work that is not about vote for me in the election 2 days from now or donate $5 for the acute crisis that is immediate. But it is the long-term work of building a base for multiracial democracy in this country for all seasons. And, I focused on, for example, an experiment in Arizona. It's happening everywhere, but I saw it in Arizona, called deep canvassing, where an army of organizers is going door to door among their own neighbors in communities across this country, talking people through their deep prejudices on issues, through their aspirations, through their values, but really going at some of the hardest issues we have on immigrant rights, on trans rights, on LGBT rights, on really hard economic issues. And what they do is they just process. They listen to people. They help people get out all of their prejudices, all of the bile that they might have about whatever group in question. And then they don't try to replace what is in that person's head. And if you've been married, you know that does not work. They try to stir up some cognitive dissonance in that person. And so to your fundamental question, I think, look, there is a hardcore 20-30% on the left that has a very baked worldview that they're not going to be talked out of at the door. There's another 20-30% equivalent on
but
the right.
But it's not just the worldview.
Quite a bit of evidence that there's a group in the middle that can move, can be toggled into different worldviews if you build a kind of process of trying to help make meaning and talk people through their views of the world.
But part of what's worrisome is not just the people who have deeply entrenched, baked ideological positions. There are people who can't accept basic facts as true. There was a poll, an Axios Momentum poll from January 2022 that found that more than 40% of Americans are either unsure or do not believe that President Biden legitimately won the election. How can you begin to persuade people, even if I spend 2 hours at the door, if I can't get them to accept basic facts, if they're still disputing fundamental truths?
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up. That is a almost separate problem, the kind of problem of persuasion in the context of disinformation and what I would call cult manipulation, which in many cases, the case of QAnon and other phenomenon, you're dealing almost with the idea of a dispersed online cult that has 43 million American adherents right now. Look, I in The Persuaders have a chapter on two different experts thinking about this problem in different ways. And what both of them said is, look, this is going to be endemic in the society right now, right? You're not going to be able to shut off disinformation. You're not going to be able to tell Elon Musk's mom that she should have raised him better and, you know, get some change on Twitter or pressure Fox News advertisers so there's no more of that. At some level, you have to accept disinformation as a feature of the internet age. What they suggest, therefore, is we need a real public health approach to disinformation, which is to say protecting people from being infected by it, not keeping it entirely out of the air. And that essentially means an educational revolution. We need a real upgrade of critical thinking to be resistant to very familiar, well-worn, repeated tactics of manipulation that show up in this disinformation question.
Fair enough. You've talked about Elon Musk already today a little bit. And we've also talked about disinformation. There are people, though, who say, look, Elon Musk buying Twitter could be a victory for free speech. Other people are saying, no, we have to think about content moderation, all forms of abuse and violence that can happen online. But either way, it's something we have to talk about. You know, what role, what impact do you think Elon Musk's acquisition of Twitter is going to have on political discourse?
Look, I think Elon Musk is not special. I think he's an embodiment of a kind of Silicon Valley type that we have come to know. And what really defines the Silicon Valley type is that they tend to be these very limited men. These are kind of just limited in the sense that these are men with a lot of power who are not particularly cultivated, don't have a particularly good understanding of human society. But when these guys make money by, you know, building an app and lucking out or making money in his case in these other businesses and kind of buying with Saudi money an app and are now in charge of kind of moderating human discourse and shaping political and civic spaces and being the guardian of spaces like Black Twitter, even though they are, you know, have kind of flirted with racist speech for years, it's a real problem. These are highly limited men who now have roles of profound responsibility for the human conversation. You know, Mark Zuckerberg, I'm not sure how many, you know, friends Mark Zuckerberg has had in life, is in charge of friendship. I mean, Elon Musk, if you ever watched Elon Musk, this is not someone who, you know, you'd say, wow, this person really gets human conversation and human interaction, but he's now in charge of what he calls the global human, you know, town square. I just think we need a system of being able to talk to each other, relate to each other, have these arguments about politics, yes, seek to persuade each other, that are not moderated by some of the people least capable at the skill of human connection.
We can't obviously ignore the fact that he's also worth approaching $200 billion. Sometimes it's more, sometimes it's less. Is it problematic, or how do you feel about the idea that a single person could amass that much wealth and have that much control over the public square, over the human conversation?
Yeah, no one should amass that kind of wealth. You know, I don't think we should have billionaires. If you don't agree with me, let's just try it my way for a little while. Let's not have them. Let's use that money to fund education and health and things like that for everyone. And then if it's not good in 10 years, I will come back on this show and suggest we go back to having billionaires if it didn't actually make the society better. But we are not, we are choosing when we have billionaires to prioritize the importance of people being able to hoard wealth over the importance of people, more people, many people being able to live good lives. It's a dumb priority on our part. And frankly, you get this other problem of these highly limited people having this huge quasi-public authority over, you know, public life, over us all, because they have nothing to do with their money except find new ways to rule us. And I think it's much better to just, you know, have a wealth tax and fund a decent life for all people.
Anand Giridharadas, thank you so much for joining us on Upfront.
Thank you for having me.
All right, that is our show. Upfront, we'll be back next week.